from KQED. From KQED Public Radio, welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Dave Iverson. In its 4.5 billion year history, planet Earth has witnessed at least 6 mass extinctions. Remarkably, whether asteroids or ice or heat or gases look like they'll bring the end of every living organism, life is persistent and reemerges. Author Anna Lee Newitz is fascinated by these doomsday scenarios, past or looming, and in her new book, she considers mass extinction in general and how we humans will impact and survive the next one. Stay with us for that conversation. It's coming your way after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in today for Dave Iverson. Well, people can debate climate change until they're blue in the face, but the reality is planet Earth has endured some pretty dramatic climate change in its 4 to 5 billion years. Assaults on the Earth are nothing new, be they from asteroids, megavolcanoes, deep freezes or broiling heat, and inhospitable gases. Major disruptions to the environment have threatened all of life on Earth repeatedly throughout the past, and at least 6 mass extinctions have taken place. What is so impressive is that despite these profound disruptions, life does endure. Some life seems to always survive. And my guest, Anna Lee Newitz, says we can learn from these past massive extinctions to see who survived and why, and perhaps glean a thing or two about how we might increase our own odds of making it through the next one. After all, another mass extinction will most certainly happen, and according to Newitz, the next big extinction may already be underway. It's something she discusses in her new book, which is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Anna Lee Newitz is the editor-in-chief of the science website io9.com. It's a daily online science and culture journal, a magazine of sorts. She's also a journalist writing for outlets like Wired and Popular Science, and is the editor of an anthology called She's Such a Geek: Women Write About Science, Technology, and Other Geeky Stuff. Anna Lee Newitz, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a term that's become just such a political lightning rod, but is simply just, it's a reality throughout the history of the planet, and that is this thing, climate change. It seems like it's at the root of all of these mass extinctions and disruptions.
That's right. One of the things that really surprised me when I was researching this book and I was looking at these 5 horrific mass extinction events that have happened in history was that I expected that they would be caused by massive disruptions like what we're familiar with from the die-off of the dinosaurs, where an asteroid hit the planet and there's fire and all kinds of horrible stuff. And you kind of imagine that these events will be instantaneous. But actually, most of these events are caused by a slow-motion disaster called climate change. And the climate change can be set off by an event like a megavolcano or an asteroid strike. But really, it's in the wake of those events that the kinds of pollutants that are released into the air, the toxins, the acids in the ocean, that really causes the full extent of a mass extinction. So you get a kind of disaster, and then over the next 1 million years, you see 75% or more species die off, and that's when you have a mass extinction. And it's quite fast in geological time.
Well, that's the thing I think that trips us all up, is when we hear about, say, the asteroids striking the Earth and the dinosaurs all dying off, we are thinking, well, that was a spectacular, catastrophic, fast event, freak of nature. But what is clear in your writing is that, yeah, it was a big catastrophic event, but then hundreds of thousands of years were really what was being, you know, endured while die-off after die-off after die-off. Talk a little bit about
the impact of, you know, these die-offs are successive. So it's one group of food sources disappears, and then another group of food sources disappears. It's long and enduring.
That's right. It's a kind of geological domino effect. So what you'll have happen, and let's go back to the dinosaurs, because again, that's, I think, the mass extinction most of us are familiar with. So 65 million years ago, we get this giant flaming ball of rock that hits the planet. So it turns out that what that does is it sets off a brief nuclear winter, which of course cools the planet. And then that's followed by a period of warming. So you have...
And let's even stop. I'm going to stop you there, because we're talking this nuclear winter. We're talking 1,000 years?
Actually, the nuclear winter probably was pretty brief, even by our human scale. So maybe 10 to 20 years of cooling. And basically, a nuclear winter is just what happens when you kick up a ton of particles into the upper atmosphere. And those particles form a cloud layer, basically, that reflects sunlight. So temperatures plummet. And the immediate effect is that plants die off because they don't have enough light. So immediately, any kind of herbivore is going to have a really tough time finding food. So you have to imagine that initially, of course, some dinosaurs die off from the impact, from the flaming, burning fire that we've all learned about in school. But then a lot of them in the subsequent decade are dying of starvation. And what happens is what we call extinction knock-on effects. So if an animal is an herbivore and it's used to eating grasses and its grasses die out, that herbivore may also go extinct, probably will go extinct. So then any creatures that are eating that herbivore, now their food source is gone too. And so they will eventually go extinct. And so it's really a good example of how mass extinctions are disasters that happen to environments or to ecosystems. They're really ways in which the ecosystem starts to unravel. And you can have individual extinctions here and there, and it seems like that's no big deal. But when you look at the big picture, what you're seeing is each extinction causes other extinctions. And so when you get that domino effect, eventually, after hundreds of thousands of years, you really look back and you can say, holy crap, 75% or more species died out. And what you're looking at that point is basically an entire world has died. The entire ecosystem that existed when the dinosaurs were around in the Cretaceous, that is gone. The plants are gone. The animals are gone. A whole new world comes into being, ruled by mammals like us. And that's happened in the planet's history already 5 times, where we've seen an entire ecosystem just unravel and disappear. But as I write, there's always survivors. And of course, if we didn't have those survivors, humans wouldn't be here. We're the kind of recipients of the survival of these creatures over time.
Well, and I think we keep coming back to the dinosaurs because that is the model that we know so well. But I want to bring it kind of into the current conversation about climate change. One of the things, whether people deny or don't deny climate change, I think the more relevant argument is whether it's human caused. I don't even know how relevant that is. But I think what people are talking about is the very speedy nature of the changes that are happening right now, possibly because of human activity. And I'm wondering what could be speedier than the catastrophic event of an asteroid hitting the planet. So, yeah, we're having a huge impact on the planet, but an asteroid hitting the planet was also a pretty darn catastrophic and fast event. And give us some context where the way we're changing the planet, maybe, it relates to something like that.
So one of the really great examples that I give is the worst mass extinction that ever happened on the planet. It's often nicknamed the Great Dying because it was really bad. 95% of all species died off at that time.
And set the story for us.
And the story is, so 250 million years ago, the Earth actually had one supercontinent because of continental drift. All the continents at that time were in one landmass. And a volcano started going off in the north in the area, which is now Siberia. And it erupted for possibly 1,000 years, possibly much longer than that. And ultimately, it released about, at a minimum, it released about a million cubic kilometers of lava. So that's enough to cover Western Europe. So what happens is it's, again, like that asteroid, it's not the burning death that's the problem. The problem is all the ash and toxins being pumped into the environment. So you have to think of, to bring it back to the contemporary era, think of an industrial revolution as being kind of equivalent to a megavolcano. It's releasing the same kinds of similar kinds of toxins and certainly releasing carbon into the environment. It's the same exact kind of cycle where you see this massive influx of carbon into the environment. And in the Permian period, which is what ended with this megavolcano, what we saw were very similar things to what we're going through now. There was massive ocean acidification. There was heavily laden, the carbon was entering the atmosphere and was heating things up. And eventually that resulted in massive starvation among animals because in the oceans, a lot of the coral reefs died off. In fact, pretty much all of them died off, which is a basic food source and habitat. And then on land, you saw plants being unable to survive. Even insects couldn't survive. And in fact, at one point, there were really only a few animals walking around on land over time. You know, it took about a million years again, but it really kind of evacuated the continent. And that was all because we were getting these incredible climate fluctuations. And the problem with climate change is it's hard to adapt to because it means your environment is changing all the time and your food sources are changing all the time. And when we look at climate change today, that's really a big concern. I mean, a big part of it is not, oh my, we'll be so hot. But actually that our food sources will dry up, that all of the places where we grow food now and where we raise animals will no longer be hospitable. And so you're going to see starvation among many animal species and many plant species, perhaps. Well, not starvation, but you'd see habitat destruction for plant species. And so that's why when we look back at geological history and we say, huh, there's a correlation between climate change and this mass extinction, it makes us worry about what's happening today because we see climate change happening. We see elevated levels of extinction among land animals. And it looks like we could be in the early stages of a sixth mass extinction. We don't know yet because, of course, these things take hundreds of thousands of years, but it doesn't look good. And so that's why it's important to intervene now.
That is Annalee Newitz, and she's the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. She's also the founding editor and editor-in-chief of science website io9.com, and that's in letter I, letter O, number 9.com, if you're interested in some fun and lively science writing. If you'd like to join in this conversation, the number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and leave some comments there. Well, let's springboard off of what you just said then. So maybe we're heading into one of these now. Adaptability is sort of that is the nugget that every species needs. And humans are, if nothing else, we're pretty darn adaptable. So talk a little bit about what our climate change experience might be. And I'm thinking of the obvious, the storms, the floods, the droughts, the heat, tsunamis. I mean, the impact will be very direct. And how we as humans in our urban world are going to or should be thinking about adjusting.
Well, there's a couple of ways we need to be thinking about this. There's one, there's just adjusting to the fact that over the next couple hundred years, we may see really dramatic climate changes. And so we need to be thinking, as they already are in Europe, for example, about where we're going to relocate farmland and where is which areas are going to be underwater that aren't underwater now, and thinking about relocating housing communities, for example. So these are obviously very important questions that are quite pressing. And it's very difficult, of course, to make those kinds of changes because they're all based on predictions. And it's very difficult when scientists say, well, we predict that Florida will be underwater. You should probably move. And when people don't see the water coming instantaneously, they don't necessarily leave. So there's that kind of preparation. But then what I really am interested in my book is ways that we might be able to actually prevent climate change from worsening. And ways that we can prevent a mass extinction from happening, because, of course, that's the most horrific outcome is a mass extinction. Because humans need other species to survive. We can't just sort of survive on a dead rock. So if we want to survive, that means we absolutely have to preserve our ecosystem. We have to preserve that interconnected net of life forms that all live off of each other and that help and that have to have a kind of cool environment to survive, because we're kind of a we're creatures that like having ice at the poles. So,
well, and let's talk about let's start with that step. How might we realistically start mediating the climate change that is probably underway?
So first of all, I like to say everything environmentalists are telling you is correct. So there's just the very basic stuff that's almost just like, you know, eat a healthy environmental breakfast. You know, reduce waste is incredibly important. Switching toward alternative fuels, getting away from burning carbon, getting away from putting toxins into the environment. And that's all stuff that is that many countries are working on. Even in the United States, there's actually been a ton of government money put into research facilities that are looking into alternative fuels. Over at UC Berkeley, there's the Center for Studying Artificial Photosynthesis, where they've got a fantastic group of scientists who are working on trying to create solar fuel generators that will be like a photovoltaic system, but instead of producing electricity, it'll actually produce a liquid fuel. And you could maybe be driving your car around with solar fuel in 50 years or hopefully sooner. So stuff like that is crucial. That's all near-term stuff. And then as we look toward the long-term, we start asking questions about what about new technologies that we might develop in 100 years or 200 years that could do things like actually pull carbon down out of the environment? Maybe we will invent machines that can do that. Probably they won't be like the machines that we think of now. There's lots of ways that we might actually use the Earth's geological processes that naturally pull carbon down from the environment, things like weathering, where literally carbon is pulled down from the atmosphere as, you know, rain is washing particles of rocks down off of mountains, for example. That's actually a natural process for pulling carbon out of the environment. Maybe we could figure out a way to speed that up or to do it artificially. So it wouldn't be destroying the environment, and we would actually be cleaning the air.
Well, and since we know this is a huge contributing factor, why is this research not just being thought about, but at full steam?
So some of it is full steam. Like I said, I mean, things like trying to invent a solar fuel generator, that is full steam. I mean, the government has put, you know, billions of dollars into trying to figure out that question, and which I think is fantastic. It's basic research that's being funded. But then things like geoengineering, which is what I was talking about just now, with kind of having artificial weathering and kind of intervening in the planet's natural carbon cycles, that stuff is, first of all, it's very futuristic, and it's also potentially quite dangerous. So there are scientists working on those questions and thinking about geoengineering. And I actually interviewed some scientists at Oxford in England about it, and they are just so cautious. You know, they are really concerned about the ethics of trying to intervene in the planet's global cycles because it affects the world. So in a way, what we need is for our global politics to catch up to the technologies. We need to have a kind of a global body that can manage those kinds of experiments before we can do the experiments. Mm. So we might actually be able to go full steam ahead. But what if one country decides, oh, we're going to try to pull carbon down out of the atmosphere? And then what if it screws up? And suddenly other countries feel like they've been attacked because their weather systems just go nuts. It could be a really weird kind of warfare that would result. So we really have to be careful with this stuff. I do think that geoengineering is very viable for the kind of the more distant future. But I think for now, we need to be setting our sights on stuff that really is conceivable, like alternative fuels is going to be a huge part of it.
So looking at some of these longer range ideas as well, you talk about cityscapes as ecosystems. You know, a huge proportion of the human population on Earth lives in urban environments, and that's a given. So that is our ecosystem right now. That's our Amazon. That's where we live as a species. Given that, and given the fact that it looks like a lot of the natural world is going to be impacted, it's going to be wiped out in one way or another, what do humans do about our own ecosystem, which is the city, or the urban environment to make it habitable?
That's actually one of my favorite questions that I got to tackle in this book. And I talked to a lot of different people, from urban designers to synthetic biologists, about what would an ideal city be like if we want to have a carbon neutral or a carbon negative city that is high density, because we're assuming that, I mean, already more than half the global population lives in cities, and that number is just going to grow. We may reach like 75% in the next 100 years. So how do we make a city that functions within the ecosystem where it is? How do we build a city that is not pumping carbon into the environment, but is actually feeding into the environment in a productive way? And there are a lot of ideas about how we might do this. I mean, one, again, is very simple. Like, we might use solar fuels. We might use wind power. We might be using the environment to create our own energy. But then, getting, again, more futuristic, we might start thinking about changing the materials that we build with. We might start building buildings that aren't just high-performance buildings, but actually made from living materials that function kind of like a body. So you might have, for example, genetically altered algae that would do things like filter the air and water, that would serve as fuel as well as, you know, a water filtration system. And so when you think about the far future of cities, and when I say far future, I really mean like, say, 200 years, you might imagine a city that is kind of like a ruin. It would be built from materials that were perhaps self-healing. So there might be bacteria that would actually heal cracks in the concrete after there was an earthquake, for example, if you live in San Francisco and you're worried about that constantly. Not that I am. You might have...
But the benefit of that being that it would mean fewer resources are drained, because you're not constantly rebuilding. If things are regenerative, you're not constantly depleting resources to rebuild things.
That's right. I mean, it's basically self-recycling. It functions like a metabolism. You want your city to function like a metabolism, in the sense that you want it to have a smart grid where energy is being allocated intelligently and you're not just draining energy off the grid. But at the same time, you want it to be built from materials that may actually be biological in nature and that are self-healing, and that do have, like I said, algae is a really big...
Boy, algae is your friend.
It's actually the building material of the future. It's quite malleable. It can do all kinds of things. It's easy to alter genetically in a non-dangerous way. And so a lot of people imagine that this future city will be like a ruin, draped in algae, kind of covered in scar tissue, and looking a bit like a Mayan city in the ruins. But actually, it'll be very productive, and you'll have all the modern conveniences on the inside. But on the outside, it'll be kind of these rusting, scarred, vine-covered hulks.
But you paint a picture of a city as a living organism. I mean, and we are components of this living organism, but that it will be, reparative, and it will be made of living, breathing beasts like your friend algae, who appears constantly as the savior.
Yeah, algae is one of the heroes of my book.
All right. Well, we're talking this hour with Annalee Newitz, and she's the author of the new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. And she's also the editor-in-chief of a science website called io9.com, and a writer as well for Popular Science and Wired Magazine, Washington Post articles in covering kind of science and culture intersections. Very interesting material. And you can also see her book, She's Such a Geek, Women Write About Science and Technology and Other Geeky Stuff. If you'd like to join in this conversation, the number is 866-733-6786, or email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. And I do assure you, we will go to calls after a break and tackle more of how humans are going to survive the apocalypse, the next mass extinction. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Dave Iverson this hour. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking with author Anna Lee Newitz about her new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. And let's go to the phone calls. Now we've got Pat calling us from Half Moon Bay. Good morning, Pat.
Morning. Perhaps I missed the first 5 minutes.
Well, that's where all the answers and questions were given. So,
exactly. I know that's what happened. Lower consumption on the part of people or on the part of society is huge, and I think a lot of low tech solutions are also viable. We don't necessarily have to go for the highly advanced technologies that are very prone to breaking. I work in high tech, and I see it all the time. The more advanced something is, greater chance it's going to break or have side effects that we can't see.
Great point. I would argue
for lower use and lower tech. And when we've exhausted those options, let's then look towards the more advanced stuff or work at it in parallel.
Thank you. And that's a great concept, this idea that maybe low-tech is the way to go. And it, not jokingly, it does bring us back to your favorite species, algae. You know, the simpler the form, the simpler the approach, the more low-tech and basic and foundational an approach might be, the more successful and enduring it might be.
That's certainly true. And, you know, with algae, which blue-green algae, which is actually cyanobacteria, have survived every single mass extinction on Earth. So they're the best model of survival we have. And one of the things that makes them such good survivors is that they are very adaptable. And it's because they evolved photosynthesis very early on, billions of years ago. And of course, if you can photosynthesize, which is basically getting energy from the sun, you can live almost anywhere. And that's because sun is so abundant. And it required for humans to make that adapt in that way, it actually took many, many thousands of years of technological advancement before we figured out how to do solar power. So I think we've actually reached the technological advancement of cyanobacteria really just quite recently. and now that we do have that ability, I think that that will allow us to adapt to our environment much better because we do have the survival skill that so many cyanobacteria had throughout history. I also think when we think about technology, people sort of imagine that technology will always be computers. And we really have to get out of that model that we are, that all future technologies or all the ways that we will use science to survive will mean, you know, typing on these little boxes or, you know, producing poisonous circuit boards that we then throw into giant piles in countries that aren't the United States. And, you know, I think as we move forward, we're going to be looking at technologies that are much more like nature. We will be working with biology. We'll be using material science. We'll be using the components of the earth and geology to create new ways of surviving. And so we may be in a very scientifically advanced culture, but it won't be one that produces all of this e-waste. It will be one that actually that uses the environment as a, almost as a kind of technology. So,
and beyond the solar concept, I'm trying to think what other very foundational low-tech concepts might be out there that would increase our survivability or also just stave off the climate change that is coming. Strategies that might be very basic and usable all over the planet, like solar. Other stuff that's going on that you know about?
I mean, I think that the main area that's important, I mean, the two areas that are most important are energy, because we depend on energy. And that's why I think alternative fuels like solar or biofuels will become very important. And then we also need to be thinking about better farming technologies, too. And I think now we've really realized that a lot of the factory farming techniques that have helped feed the world are now actually poisoning the oceans. So it's not great if we feed everyone, but there's ocean acidification from nutrient runoff from farms. So we now need to be thinking about better ways and more efficient ways of producing things like fertilizer. We can do things like use biochar for fertilizer, which can be a really efficient way and a carbon negative way of fertilizing fields. And maybe think about doing smaller farms, more diverse farms as well. having plant diversity is incredibly important, and having animal diversity is important too, obviously. So when we think about the future of how we want to do food, having diverse crops is a really big part of it. And again, it's low tech. It's a matter of changing our food practices.
Well, and the lowest tech of all would be to not cut down certain forests. I mean, that is the lowest tech of all. It's letting things be as they – there's a system worked out already to keep the carbon cycle as it should be. And the deforestation, which is an action, if that inaction was in place instead, right there, that's a pretty low-tech approach.
Habitat preservation is really, really important. And in some cases, we have to actually restore natural habitats. You know, say, for example, bringing wolves back to environments where they had been eliminated. But one thing that's really – that we have to be careful about when we talk about the carbon cycle, and people will say, well, let the earth do its natural thing. Let it go through its carbon cycles naturally. So if we do that, if we just let the earth go through its carbon cycles naturally, we are totally screwed because – the planet naturally goes through periods of climate change where it will go into a greenhouse if we don't prevent it. So our nice, happy ice house where we have ice at the poles and everything is cool the way we like it, that is not going to be there forever. And in fact, throughout most of Earth's history, we haven't had ice at the poles. So if we want to survive in comfort and we want all of our animal and plant friends to survive with us, we are going to eventually have to intervene in a big way in the carbon cycle and actually prevent it from doing its natural thing so that we can keep the earth the way we like it. So in a sense, we are going to
we're fighting the natural trend just for our own survivability anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I've got some comments here from listeners. One says, "Does your guest know about biomimicry? It's being used more and more to guide the development of buildings and built environments in city planning. There's a recent report called The Genius of Biome." And an architect at global firm HOK proposes to use biomimicry to rebuild post-Superstorm Sandy. Anything you're familiar with?
Yeah, no, I'm very interested in biomimicry. And that is part of what I was talking about earlier when I suggested that we would have these sort of living cities and cities that imitated metabolisms. And biomimicry is just a term that describes technologies or constructions that imitate biological
systems,
exactly, or actually organisms. And it's actually hugely important in robotics as well, as we're developing machines that act and behave like animals, or that look like animals too.
Ryan tweets in, "We would not be facing the climate apocalypse if we had constructive smart energy legislation, but honestly, no one is prepared." So that's Ryan tweeting in. And Chris in Oakland is joining us now. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Excellent program. I've got a comment and a question. I'm on the board of AC Transit, and we are running buses on solar-generated fuel today. We have about $6 million worth of solar cells. We use that to produce electricity. We use that to hydrolyze water, produce hydrogen, and that it produces about 65 kilograms of hydrogen a day, which is enough to run about 2.5 of our fuel cell buses. And there's a lot of work being done on your favorite friend, blue-green algae, and using it to produce hydrogen. That's my comment. My question is, how do you get Americans to think beyond the next quarter?
Hey, that's a big one.
It is a big one, and it's one of the reasons why – that was one of the questions I really struggled with in this book, and it was part of why I wanted to emphasize the length of Earth's history and human history and how long we've been struggling with a lot of these problems around famine and survival and environmental change, because it's been a constant refrain both in the history of humanity and the history of Earth. And I think what really helps is for people to – be able to think about the next quarter, which is very important, and it's our natural inclination to be worried about that, but also to see how that fits into a larger narrative of survival. And we do think about those larger narratives all the time. It's one of the reasons why, for example, it's very interesting to think about space exploration, because not because it's necessarily going to happen tomorrow, which it's not, But because it's part of a long project that humans have been involved in, where we started looking at the stars thousands of years ago and eventually launched spaceships into outer space. And that was a project where little tiny bits of advancement happened over many, many lifetimes. And on a smaller scale, things like cities are a similar kind of project where little bits of the city are built during a human lifetime, but that city continues on after that. And so if we can think about those kinds of long-term projects where humans have built a space program together over thousands of years or built cities together over thousands of years, that helps us have a mental picture of what it's like to think about a long-term project that we participate in. And the thing that's great, especially if you're thinking about cities, is that it allows you to think about what are the short-term benefits I get by, say, having hydrogen-fueled buses, but then what are the long-term benefits for the city that may last, you know, hundreds of years after my own death? And the long-term benefits are we're making decisions now that will allow us to have a city that runs on alternative fuels tomorrow. But we have to have both of those stories in our heads, the short term and the long term.
Well, and as an organism, I mean, we are an organism ourselves. And so it makes some degree of sense. I mean, what he was saying makes sense. A quarter is a season. And we've grown up, you know, raising crops and living in these shortened timelines of seasons and then years and then generations. And so I do think probably for people thinking out beyond three generations, perhaps, so you would say it would be down to grandchildren, would be a natural timeline for the human mind to sort of encompass. And it's going to take a hurdle for us to think longer than that because our natural biology gives us our own little sweep of time.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, when I talk to geologists, one of the things that would happen a lot is they would talk about things happening in human time. And human time is just silly and short compared to a lot of these trends that we're talking about. So my goal is to really get people thinking in species time. And a typical mammalian species like a human, that species usually has about a million year time span. So let's just start thinking about like that species time, that million years that we've got. We evolved maybe 200,000 years ago, so we've got at least 800,000 years left to play with. So let's start thinking about what we might do in that time.
All right, Mike and Benicia, join us.
Yes, hi. I just had a comment. You know, I have a friend. We were actually having a discussion yesterday, and even though we both live in the Bay Area, he's a climate change denier. And, you know, 99% of climate scientists can't be wrong. But anyway, what he tried to explain to me was the fact that the atmosphere is comprised of, 78% nitrogen and 20.9% oxygen. So what he said was, you know, that other 1.1% is a variety of other things. And his rationale was that tweaking the amount of carbon dioxide by 0.01%, whatever it is, it has no effect whatsoever on the climate. And I was just baffled at that. And I tried to explain to him, you know, that we have certain toxins that when they're added to a water supply, I mean, parts per million or parts per billion can be dangerous, but he just wasn't buying it. And I just was hoping you could make a comment on that.
Well, and that speaks to this whole question of people who say this is such a small and incremental change, it really doesn't bear out as something that we need to worry about. Annalie?
Yeah, it's very hard because, as I said earlier, this is a kind of a slow motion disaster. And it's hard to wrap our minds around a disaster that unfolds in geological time versus in human time. But we can look back in the geological record and see absolutely by analyzing the chemical composition of these rocks that we have that indeed, fluctuations in the amount of carbon in the environment have caused radical changes, cause temperature fluctuations, cause a transformation in the chemistry of the ocean. And this can really affect which life forms survive. And again, some are going to survive, but a lot of them won't.
Well, and it's funny because even if it's this very, as Mike's friend is thinking, this very negligible change, storms, tsunamis, floods, droughts, famines, species dying off as a result of habitat loss. So it might be a very, very small change in the CO2 or something, but the effects are huge.
The effects are huge, and they're knock-on effects over time.
That's that knock-on term where it's cumulative. It's domino.
Right. It's cumulative. So the more deaths you have, the more deaths you'll get. And I'll share a terrifying statistic with you, which I got from a zoologist here at the Cal Academy, Peter Rupnarine. And he studies how mass extinctions unfold over time by looking at previous ones. And one of the things that he and his colleagues have found is that you can knock out about 40% of species in an ecosystem, and it pretty much stays stable. So you literally can just be like, kill off species after species. When you hit that 40% mark, that's when things go pear-shaped. You suddenly get this incredibly steep upward curve in extinctions. That seems to be the tipping point based on their research. And so it seems fine, like, oh, well, all this stuff is dying off and, you know, things seem pretty much the same. But then you hit that point and you're going to start seeing massive knock-on effects and massive die-offs, taking you right up to that 75% of species dying off.
Are there other tipping points that you've been made aware of that are going to cause, you know, significant exponential change? So, creep, 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 and this amount of CO2 or this amount of methane or other things where we're going to hit a tipping point. Or maybe we don't know yet because we haven't been in that situation.
I mean, we do know that there are runaway effects caused by having more CO2 in the environment. So the more carbon you have, the more you get, the more you get die-offs. And of course, the more death, the more carbon goes into the environment. And for example, one of the things that happens in the oceans when you have more carbon in the environment is you get ocean acidification, which then causes the death of things like coral reef communities. And that puts more dead bodies into the environment, which is more carbon. And so eventually the ocean itself is releasing more carbon into the environment. And eventually more things happen, like perhaps the methane clathrates melt, which are just big deposits of frozen methane under the ocean. And if those melt, then you get more greenhouse gas. And so that, again, that's a runaway effect. So just more of the toxins in the environment building on each other and heating things up even more and making it harder for life to maintain itself.
So many things to get to here. And I have a lot of emails and tweets and comments, so I'm going to take to some of those now. David writes in, what about taking an even bigger view and considering the possibility that extinction is a natural, acceptable outcome for our ecostructure and allowing the next dominant species to have their time at bat, so to speak? And this is something you tackle. Humans, though, we're pretty resilient.
Yeah, we are pretty resilient. There have been many other mass extinctions, as I mentioned, and species like humans tend to be survivors. We're very adaptable. We can live in many environments, and we have a huge population. So even if you take out several billion of us, you've still got a few billion left. So I think it's very likely we are going to see population crashes like that in the future from famines and from climate change. But we're still going to hang on, I think, even in pretty large numbers.
Is there a possibility, though, that the human species might be wiped out by pathogens or disease or something which would rebalance?
It's possible. I mean, and again, balance is a really interesting question because, of course, we are part of the ecosystem. And, throughout Earth's history, there have been species that had large populations and species that were specialists that had smaller populations. So we actually are a natural part of things. It's possible that there would be a pathogen that would take out a huge amount of our species, something like the Black Plague, which really cut the population of Europe almost in half by some estimates, or maybe by a third by other estimates. So it's unlikely that something like that would kill all of us. I think that's a fun science fiction scenario, but I don't think it's likely. But like I said, I do think there probably will have to be some kind of event where our population shrinks just because we're heading into a time of extreme climate instability. So it's likely to result in a lot of deaths. So those of you who love the apocalypse, have fun.
Well, and I think David's comment of another species getting an at-bat, I don't think humans are going away very quickly, very soon. So I think we're going to be sticking around because we're we're a pretty resilient, adaptable group. Beth tweets, what about using wind in small ways everywhere in cityscapes for power? Also, what about city apartment farming that is wholly recycled, as in the water, the waste, etc.?
I love both of those ideas. You're hired.
All right, she's hired. Another David writes, does your author know about Alan Savory's work in regenerating desiccated and desertified lands? I'd be interested in hearing thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his work specifically, but there's a lot of really interesting work going on now with that idea, with restoring habitats, but also with de-extincting creatures that are either near extinction or already extinct to try to restore habitats that existed thousands of years ago. And I think those are interesting questions. The idea of habitat remediation to me is very attractive. I think that's something that we're going to have to be doing. And it's being done in small ways all over the U.S. and elsewhere. And it's the only way we're going to survive. We're going to have to maintain the environments that are healthy for us.
Well, stretching a little bit into the territory of sci-fi, but maybe not. I don't really know. This idea that humans with a resilience in one area or another, so some people who are particularly resilient in their DNA to one quality of living, and another group that maybe is resilient to, I think an example I heard you talking about was radiation. Human DNA in and of itself is variable, and people's resistance to certain calamities might be variable itself. So talk a little bit about that and whether scientists sort of are honing in on that or interested in it, looking at it, just human variability and resilience.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a huge focus right now in medical research, but also in synthetic biology to a certain extent. I think right now we're just looking at how we might design better medicines based on people's DNA. But also perhaps in the future, we might be thinking about how to improve people's ability to survive, for example, in a situation where there's a lot of radiation. That might be in deep space where there's lots of radiation, or it might be if there's some sort of horrible radiation accident.
But what are other natural phenomena that people's adaptability would really matter? And I'm thinking about the big climate-based ones of mm-hmm. famine, drought, heat, cold. Would anything in our DNA be advantageous in one of those situations or the other?
I think in those situations, what's really advantageous is our brilliant tool-making ability. Mm-hmm. Because when you're dealing with harsh environments, I mean, it's really the tools that save you. Can you build a city that's resilient against weather changes? Can you wear warm clothes that allow you to go out even in the cold? Or can you build an underground city if there's a disaster that makes the surface of the planet unlivable? So I think that's really where humans are an incredibly great survival species, because not only are we adaptable, but we're great tool makers.
All right. Let's go to Cole calling from San Francisco. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had a question.
Okay.
And my question was, what do you think the first species that will be to die off in the next mass extinction?
Excellent question.
Thanks, Cole. So we already here's an interesting thought experiment for you. So the reason why scientists think that we might be in the early stages of a mass extinction is because actually we've already seen a lot of die-offs in land animals, and probably the first of those die-offs would have been what we call megafauna, which were the mastodons and the giant sloths and all of the really large animals that lived in the Americas and in Australia before humans got here. And shortly after humans arrived in the Americas, say around 15,000 years ago, we started to see die-offs among these really large animals. And now, of course, they're entirely extinct.
And you're talking about things that might be studied in school, like a mammoth.
Yeah, woolly mammoth,
saber-tooth,
mastodons, yeah, saber-tooth cats, just large mammals, basically. And like I said, we call them megafauna because it sounds cool, but also because it's scientifically accurate. And all of those creatures are dead now. So those were probably the first casualties of a sixth mass extinction, if indeed one is underway.
And then any thoughts on what the next grouping might be?
So we can't be sure. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities. Obviously, coral reefs are in danger, and all of the life forms that live on and among coral reefs. Birds are in danger. Amphibians are in danger. I love frogs and salamanders, and I often feel quite sad that it may be the case that they won't make it to the next century. So let's hope that that doesn't happen.
They're very, very sensitive to climate change, to any kind of
they're
moist
sensitive
water
to habitat change. Yeah. A lot of them are specialist species, which means they can only live in very specific habitats. And if you change that habitat, they're dead. So the kinds of species that tend to go extinct first in a mass extinction are those specialist species that really that only live on one kind of food, that can only live in one kind of temperature. And they if things change, then they're vulnerable.
All right, Cole. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
So in the last few moments that we've got here on the show, what might some of our strategies be in dealing with the reality of a climate change that does seem to be underway, and a resistant sort of political structure or our resistance to change? What would you say are a few things that we humans can be doing here and now? You've talked a little bit about the reducing consumption, friendlier environmental policies.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that stuff is great. Again, it's a lot of it is really common sense stuff. You know, we really do need to be focusing on alternative energies. We really need to be focusing hard on redesigning our cities so that going forward, our cities can be as carbon neutral as possible and can work with our ecosystems instead of against them the way they do now. So I think a lot of the near term work that needs to be done really is going to be focused on changing city life and really thinking hard about how to do that. And that also means changing city government to a certain extent.
Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic in the long term. So when I talk about that species view, the million-year view of humanity, I think Homo sapiens will survive. I really hope we evolve into something else, just like most other animals do, usually over time. What happens is either you go extinct or you speciate, you turn into multiple other species. So I think that can happen for us. I think in the near term, that's where all the questions are. So to me, the big question is not whether we will survive, but what that survival will look like.
And what our planet will look like.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us. That's Annalee Newitz. She's the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Also, she's the founding editor and editor-in-chief of io9.com. That's the letter I, the letter O, the number 9.com. And it's a science and science fiction website. And also, she's a contributing writer for various magazines. And thanks so much to all of you who called in and wrote into the show as well. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Dan Zoll is the senior editor, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Engineering the show today is Howard Gelman. I'm Penny Nelson here today for Dave Iverson. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.